I'm talking about the relationship between trans liberation and feminism, I'm going to start with a lot of the theoretical stuff. I know it's early, so bear with me there. And then I'm going to get into some history, and I'm going to tie it all together with how it applies to today and what we should be doing about that stuff. I want to get to a lot, and I don't want to take up too much time. I don't need some time for discussion, so I won't be able to flesh everything out as much as I might want. But hopefully some of the gaps can be filled by discussion, and there's also going to be a couple more talks later that will more flesh out some of what I'm going to touch on. So trans people in this country have made important gains in recent years in visibility and acceptance, and in some cases legal protections, but those gains have been far from sufficient and are facing a backlash. It should be an urgent project of the left to develop a coherent and consistent set of politics that informs the strategy we use to fight against this oppression. There have been many recent contributions to the theoretical understanding of gender-based oppression, and in particular from a Marxist feminist perspective. There's also a rich history of trans struggle to draw on and learn lessons from. It's important for those on the left to be up to date on the important theoretical contributions to learn from the lessons of past struggle to fight for a liberatory vision of the future. So I'm going to start with one of the theoretical contributions, which has been the further development of social reproduction theory. There's an entire session later on social reproduction theory and gender liberation, so go to that if you're interested. I'll see you there. But I'll give a brief overview here. So social reproduction theory is an attempt to extend a Marxist analysis of labor and production to include the work that goes into producing and reproducing labor power. The working class uses our labor power to produce all the wealth that gets expropriated from us by the capitalists. That wealth includes what's returned to us as a wage and the surplus value that's extracted by our bosses. One of the main insights of social reproduction theory is the acknowledgement that the labor power that we use in the process of production must itself be produced. The production of labor power is what's referred to as social reproduction. This includes things like feeding ourselves, cooking food, washing dishes, washing ourselves, cleaning our living space, getting ourselves to and from work, participating in leisure activities to recharge and be mentally prepared to go back to work. Social reproduction also takes into account the way that society replaces workers who exit the workforce due to injury, illness, retirement, etc. This involves the generational replacement of workers, so like having kids, raising them, teaching them, stuff like that. It also includes caring for people who can't work due to injury or illness. The work of healthcare workers can be seen as helping people who currently are not able to work get back to work, and is therefore an essential part of social reproduction. Globally, the work of social reproduction is performed primarily by women and is often unpaid or undervalued and underpaid. I don't think it's a coincidence that in the era of Me Too, we've seen an upsurge of struggle in workplaces that fall under the realm of social reproduction. Things like teachers, hotel workers, nurses, going on strike, and also the recent strike of behavioral health workers at Kaiser in California. So the fact that women disproportionately bear the burden of the work of social reproduction has to do with sexist ideas that suggest that women are predisposed to want to do that work. I'd like to introduce a couple terms now coined by trans writer, activist, and scientist Julia Serrano to help describe two different types of sexism that can be useful in describing how sexist ideas lead to women doing the majority of the reproductive labor and how that work is devalued. The first of those terms is oppositional sexism, which Serrano uses to describe how the idea that men and women are two fundamentally different and opposite types of people. The other is traditional sexism, which is the hierarchical form of sexism that suggests manhood and masculinity is superior to womanhood and femininity. So oppositional sexism is the thing that suggests that women innately desire to do the work of social reproduction, and traditional sexism suggests that they don't need to be paid very much, if at all, for it. Most of us are familiar with the stereotypes that go along with oppositional and traditional sexism. These are things like women being more nurturing, passive, better at understanding people's emotions, things like that. And men are allegedly better systematizers or better with numbers and science and more authoritative. The stereotypes attributed to women allegedly result in them being enjoying or being naturally better at the work of social reproduction, while the stereotypes attributed to men imply that they're better at, more better suited for the work that's more directly produces value for capitalists. Oppositional sexism isn't just about men and women being fundamentally different, though. Implicit in oppositional sexism is biological determinism. The idea that the idea isn't just that men and women are different and opposite, but it's also that people with certain kinds of bodies are predisposed to be a certain type of way and fulfill certain roles, and people with other types of bodies are supposed to be a different way and fulfill different roles. This is the foundation of the gender binary, and it's fundamentally transphobic and cissexist. The concept of transitioning is incompatible with oppositional sexism. Non-binary gender identities are also contradict oppositional sexism. Trans people living as and being accepted as a gender other than the one that they were assigned at birth challenges the idea that gender is an immutable characteristic defined by our genitalia or genetics or something like that. There's a significant amount of pop psychology that is attempting to empirically prove the differences between the brains of people who are assigned male at birth or versus who people are assigned female at birth. Many of those researchers set out to empirically prove that the stereotypes that support the idea of oppositional sexism are grounded in biological truth. The methodologies of these studies are heavily influenced by the ideas of the researchers themselves and the stereotypes that they've internalized, and often end up being self-fulfilling prophecies. I want to go through a couple examples to further illustrate this point. I'm also, I work in mental health care and I'm kind of a nerd, so I kind of enjoy debunking shitty psych research. So sorry if that's not relatable, but we're going to do it anyway. The examples I got were from a book called Delusions of Gender by Cordelia Fine. And I picked two, but there's dozens and dozens in there, and the whole book is just kind of like debunking all of this stuff, so, and it's in the book room if you're interested. So the first one I'm going to talk about compared the amount of time newborns spent looking at a mobile versus a research assistant's face. The researchers said that babies spending longer times looking at the mobile were systematizers, where babies who were more drawn to faces were empathizers. And all the babies spent about the same amount of time looking at faces, but the male babies spent 10% longer looking at the mobile. The lead researcher on the study is a guy named Simon Baron Cohen. If that last name sounds familiar, it's because this guy is Sacha Baron Cohen's cousin. gross, right? He wrote a book called Why Aren't More Women in Science? Because we needed a man to write that book. And in that book, he uses this particular study where just 10% of babies spent longer time looking at, or male babies spent longer time looking at mobiles, to say that, quote, biases in attention to things rather than faces in boys and vice versa in girls is due to partly innate differences. And the study suggests that we should not expect the sex ratio in occupations such as math and science to ever be 50-50 if we leave the workplace to simply reflect the number of applicants of each sex who are drawn to such fields. So yeah, even before like looking at the methodological flaws in the study, it should be like clear that drawing such far-reaching conclusions from one study of 102 babies is like ridiculous. But we should consider the methodological flaws though, because like I said, it's fun. The stimuli, the faces and the mobiles, were presented sequentially and not at the same time, so there it leaves the potential for other external factors affecting the baby's attention that aren't their intrinsic affinity for systematizing or empathizing. Also, some babies were tested lying down while others were sitting on their parents' lap, so the viewing angle changed, which actually does matter quite a bit because babies are drawn to more top-heavy stimuli, so that could have affected things. And the final and most important flaw is the fact that the researchers didn't control for something called the experimenter expectancy effect. So the person whose face was one of the stimuli also almost certainly knew the assigned sex of the babies at the time of testing, because they didn't control for they didn't request that like gendered decorations be removed before testing, and the babies were tested in the hospital rooms of their parents. And if you've ever been in a hospital room shortly after a baby was born, you'll know that the assigned sex of the baby is telegraphed fairly loudly in those spaces. There was actually another group of researchers who attempted to replicate the results, but like took care to control for the experimental expectancy effect, and found no difference in time spent looking at either stimulus. But that study didn't make it into Simon Baron Cohen's book. Another example that I want to talk about is a study that some researchers did involving putting six toys of different gender categories into an enclosure of vervet monkeys. The toys included two neutral toys, two boyish toys, and two girlish toys. The girl toys were a doll and a pan, and the boy toys were a police car and a ball. Yeah. If you're questioning why a pan was used, yeah, same. Monkeys can't cook, so that's weird. And yeah, what does a cop car mean to a monkey also? Anyway, male monkeys played about the same amount of time with all three categories, but female monkeys played a little bit more with the girl toys. And the study probably seems ridiculous to most of the people in this room, but it's been used by very serious academic types to say things like, this suggests inborn differences in sex type toy preference, and it's been called another nail in the coffin for the idea that similar preferences in human children are entirely due to culture. If you actually like Google about this, there's a lot of people who cite the study saying that like this proves that there's innate like preferences for human children and toys, but it's clearly ridiculous. Anyway, so I include these examples to show how sexist ideas can be naturalized through academic institutions. Many people believe that oppositional sexism is a reflection of natural sexual dimorphism, and this has been proved by science, but the inverse is closer to the truth. The traits attributed to men and women by sexist ideology heavily influence biological and psychological research. Nature isn't the material cause of gender-based oppression the way we organize society is. Science has always been used as a tool by those in power to justify their dominance over select groups of people. Race science was used to justify slavery and segregation. Trans people have been battling medical and psychiatric professionals for decades to get access to transition. Science is not a neutral progressive force that stands outside of society. Scientists often tell the predominant ideas of the society that they exist in. If nature isn't the origin of oppositional sexism, though, where do those ideas come from? So societies that existed before classes developed had very different ideas about gender and often had very different divisions of labor. There are many examples of societies that have included people whose genders didn't fit into any binary, and colonialism played a huge role in erasing those conceptions of gender by exporting and violently enforcing the gender roles that had developed in Europe. It continues to be important for capital to enforce these gender roles. Normalizing the nuclear family structure is a way of trying to make the work of social reproduction invisible by confining it to the home and privatizing it. Capitalists need social reproduction to happen so that they can have a continuous supply of labor power to exploit, but they don't want to pay for it. Early in the process of industrialization and the onset of capitalism, there is the concept of the family wage. This describes wages paid to male workers that were supposed to be sufficient to cover the living expenses of themselves and their wives and children. This didn't happen, of course, and many women had to work for a wage in addition to doing the social reproduction work at home. And the family wage that their husbands were allegedly getting was used as justification to pay them like next to nothing for that work they were doing. And also this whole like going to work and then doing the social reproduction work at home led to what feminists have described as the second shift. So the concept of the family wage, which is heteronormative and cisnormative, serves as a justification for the hyper-exploitation of working class women and has resulted in an increased flow of value from workers to capitalists. Capitalists will always use their control of and influence on various institutions to promote and reproduce ideas that benefit themselves. I'd like to discuss a recent example of this. Shortly after Trump was elected, a group of think tanks, some liberal and some conservative, came together to construct what they called a bipartisan plan of action. That plan promoted a slew of neoliberal policies, but one of those policies was promoting something called the success sequence. The success sequence is defined as, quote, the idea that all young people should first get a college degree, then marry, then have children in order to ensure a successful life. They say that, like, people that suggests that people who are successful follow that sequence, and without like thinking about why that might be. And the report also argues that tax policy should be constructed to incentivize this sequence of events. So promoting the idea that you must get married and then have children with your spouse in order to have a successful life benefits for those who would prefer the labor of raising children to remain privatized and perform for free. And limiting the resources that are offered to people who don't volunteer their labor to reproduce the working class is a way to coerce people into doing this work for free. This framework also excludes people who do socially reproductive work that falls outside of traditional family structures or private homes. And this report shows one way that the state can use tax policy and add requirements for social programs to suggest people conform to traditional gender roles. And the state also uses or exerts significant control over people's bodily autonomy to enforce those roles. The reproduction of sexist ideology in line with biological determinism requires massive, intrusive control of the bodies of a lot of people. As I said earlier, the idea of transitioning is incompatible with the idea of oppositional sexism. Allowing people to live as their gender when that gender is different from the one that they were assigned at birth would cause people to question the very nature of the gender roles many take as given now. Preventing people from having access to transition, or at least reducing the visibility of people who are or have transitioned, is therefore essential to the persistence of sexist ideology. Likewise, oppositional sexism dictates that people who can have children are meant to have children and raise them. Capitalists, therefore, have incentive to limit their control in that process. The idea that people who are pregnant can choose not to be pregnant anymore is unacceptable to people who rely on a steady supply of new workers to maintain their profits. Opposing that idea requires similar massive control over people's bodies. What's at stake here is people's bodily autonomy, both in the case of reproductive justice and trans people having access to transition. Capitalists limit bodily autonomy in both cases in order to reinforce sexist ideas that are required in order to maintain our current system of social reproduction. The ideas that come from the ruling class and filter down to the working class come from the material conditions that exist under the way we organize our society. Under capitalism, the ruling class is incentivized to promote ideas that lower the cost to capitalists of the reproduction of labor power. When the cost of the reproduction of labor power is lower, the cost of all labor is reduced, and the capitalists can extract even more surplus value from the work that we perform. The restriction of bodily autonomy and self-determination of women and trans people goes hand in hand with the sexist ideas that suggest people are meant to fulfill certain roles based on the gender they were assigned at birth. The naturalization of women's role in the reproduction of labor power has the effect of devaluing that work. Because if a group of people derives some sort of intrinsic pleasure from the work that from certain types of labor, that intrinsic reward is used as justification for that labor being unpaid or underpaid. Therefore, reinforcing oppositional sexism results in an increased flow of surplus labor from the working class to the capitalist class. Since the acceptance of trans people's genders threatens the validity of oppositional sexism, the material source of the oppression of women and trans people are connected. This connection should inform the strategies we use in order to fight back against this oppression. We can look back at social movements that have come and gone to see how incorporating this understanding of the interconnectedness of the sources of oppression helped grow movements, and how siloing off different groups had the opposite effect. So I'd like to shift gears a little bit and talk about some history. And I'd like to focus specifically on 1973. This is a pivotal year in the history of trans struggle. A lot of the isolation that occurred in the following decades was cemented in 1973. One of the pivotal events in 1973 was the San Francisco Pride Parade. To give some context, you have to take a step back and look at the year before, 1972. in that year in the Pride Parade, a member of a lesbian separatist contingent was carrying a sign that said "Off the Pricks." An organizer of the parade, who was a cis gay man, tried to get the woman to put the sign down because it violated the event's policy against violent imagery. And the argument devolved into a fist fight, and after the event, the lesbian separatists and their allies decided to boycott any events organized by the same organizers and plan their own Pride Parade for the next year in 73. And the one they planned explicitly excluded drag queens and trans people, calling them people who mock women. They would go on to continue to organize the San Francisco Pride Parade for many years after and continue to exclude and ban drag queens and trans women. Another incident that occurred the same year was the West Coast Lesbian Feminist Conference. At that conference, a singer, trans lesbian singer named Beth Elliott was scheduled to perform. Members of the lesbian separatist organization called the Gutter Dykes Collective protested Beth Elliott's participation at the conference. They threatened to disrupt the whole event if Elliott was allowed to stay. Eventually a vote was taken, and two-thirds of the conference voted to actually allow Elliott to stay, but the one-third minority that said that they wanted her kicked out said that they were going to disrupt the whole conference anyway if she was allowed to stay. So she did her initial performance and then left for the rest of the conference. And Robin Morgan, who was the keynote speaker at the conference, spent a significant portion of her keynote hurling transphobic abuse at Beth Elliott. She accused Beth Elliott of being responsible for dividing the conference and said that she felt compelled to defend the conference from people who, quote, deliberately re-emphasize gender roles and who parody female oppression and suffering, end quote. She also accused Beth Elliott of, quote, leeching off women who have spent their entire lives as women and women's bodies, and ended her speech by calling Beth Elliott, quote, an opportunist, an infiltrator, and a destroyer with the mentality of a rapist. Yeah. This whole idea of trans women being rapists and inherently predatory started with, was kind of popularized by these people, saying that trans women being in women's spaces was like rape because it was like men invading women's spaces non-consensually. But the stereotype of trans women being inherently predatory persists today and is one of the things that are used to try to promote these bathroom bills that have been popping up. Another event worth highlighting in 1973 is the Pride Parade on the other coast in New York City. Sylvia Rivera, one of the co-founders of Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries, or STAR, and also a member of the revolutionary Puerto Rican organization called the Young Lords, was trying to speak at the event, but organizers tried to prevent her from being able to address the crowd. Some of you might have seen the video of her speech when she finally got up. It's great, you should watch it. I'm gonna read some of what she said, because it's awesome. She said, "I've been trying to get up here all day. I've been to jail. I've been raped and beaten many times by men, heterosexual men. I will no longer put up with this shit. I have had my nose broken. I've lost my job. I've lost my apartment for gay liberation. And you all treat me this way? What the fuck's wrong with you? I believe in gay power. I believe in us getting our rights, or I would not be out there fighting for our rights. That's all I want to say to you people. Come and see the people at Star House. The people there are trying to do something for us, all of us. Not just men and women that belong to a white middle-class club. And that's what you belong to." Sylvia Rivera was somebody who played a large part in building the gay rights movement in the late 60s and early 70s. So trying to exclude her from a Pride event was a slap in the face. It's also worth mentioning that when she said people at STAR aren't just fighting for the rights of white middle-class people, she meant that one of STAR's first public appearances was their contention at a Young Lords event. She would later describe how that event shaped her politics. She said, "There was a mass demonstration that started in East Harlem in the fall of 1970. The protest was against police repression, and we decided to join the demonstration with our STAR banner. This was one of the first times the STAR banner was shown in public where STAR was present as a group. I ended up meeting some of the Young Lords that day. I became one of them. Anytime they needed help, I was always there for the Young Lords. It was just the respect they gave us as human beings. They gave us a lot of respect. It was a fabulous feeling for me to be myself, being part of the Young Lords as a drag queen, and my organization, STAR, being part of the Young Lords." Sylvia Rivera's experiences and speech show that she had a deep understanding of politics, the politics of solidarity, and she did what she could to apply that understanding in her organizing and actions. She understood the struggle against colonialism and police repression to be tied to the struggles that trans and gender nonconforming people face. Another important event in 1973 was the Roe v. Wade decision. This came at the height of the feminist movement in the late 60s and early 70s. Howard Zinn would describe this movement and the decision by saying, the right of a woman to an abortion did not depend on the Supreme Court decision in Roe v. Wade. It was won before that decision, all over the country, by grassroots agitation that forced states to recognize the right. If the American people, who by a great majority favor that right, insist on it, act on it, no Supreme Court decision can take it away. The rights of working people, of women, of black people, have not depended on decisions by the courts. Like other branches of the political system, the courts recognize these rights only after citizens have engaged in direct and powerful enough action to win these rights for themselves. So this victory was won by the mass movement, demanding reproductive justice, and wouldn't have happened without that movement. It was a high point in struggle, but calling something a high point implies that it precedes a fall. The decades following this historic victory were marked by the onset of neoliberalism. Part of the proliferation of neoliberal ideology was the siloing off of different movements and creation of divisions between different groups fighting against attacks on their rights. Trans people were one of the first to be isolated, and I chose the stories I did to show how that isolation started to occur. As a result of the isolation, organizations that fought for trans liberation, like STAR, focused less on protests and direct action and turned inward, becoming more focused on mutual aid and survival. The result of the inward turn in isolation was that the feminist movements and the movement for gay and lesbian rights lost badass and committed revolutionaries like Sylvia Rivera. This wasn't the only reason for the decline of social movements in the 70s and 80s, but it certainly didn't help. Movements are stronger when they're in solidarity with one another. It's one of the primary reasons for the success of movements throughout the 60s and early 70s. We must draw the lessons, the successes for these periods, from these periods. The ideas of the lesbian separatists haven't gone away. They can still be found in mainstream news outlets like The Guardian. Many of you might be familiar with an infamous Guardian editorial that was published last fall on the Gender Recognition Act in Britain. One of the worst things about it, and there are many bad things about it, was the way that it counterposes fighting transphobia and fighting misogyny. The police says, quote, transphobia must be opposed, but misogyny too must be challenged. Gender identity does not cancel out sex. Women's oppression by men has a physical basis, and to deny the relevance of biology when considering sexual inequality is a mistake. Women's concerns about sharing dormitories or changing rooms with male-bodied people must be taken seriously. Male-bodied was actually in scare quotes in the article, and calling trans women male-bodied is clearly transphobic. But besides that, the argument tries to give legitimacy to the kind of arguments that are used in favor of the bathroom bills and suggests that those arguments are compatible with the fight for reproductive justice and the fight against sexual assault. But we know that trans people don't assault women in bathrooms and often are assaulted and harassed in bathrooms. We also know that the fight for bodily autonomy can and should encompass demands for reproductive justice and trans rights. The title of the Guardian article is Where Rights Collide. The framing of the article serves to reinforce the divisions that popped up in 1973 and only weakened movements at a critical moment when solidarity was crucial to the movement's continued strength and success. We need to learn lessons of the past so we don't repeat the same mistakes today. We're again at a critical juncture. Explosive but short-lived struggle has been popping up over the past few years, and those struggles could potentially cohere into a mass movement. We need to be clear in our politics so that we can intervene in the upcoming movement in order to ensure that it's as strong as it can be with the best chance to win significant gains. Right now, the only civil rights protections that exist at a federal level for trans people are based on interpretation of clauses that prohibit discrimination on the basis of sex, as including discrimination on, the only civil rights protections are the ones that interpret discrimination on the basis of sex as including gender identity of expression. So the wording just says sex, and that's been interpreted as including gender identity. But the Trump administration has been chipping away at those protections, and there was a memo leaked in the New York Times last fall that made clear the administration's intentions. The memo reads, sex means a person's status as a male or female based on the immutable biological traits identified by or before birth. The sex listed on the person's birth certificate as originally issued shall constitute definitive proof of a person's sex unless rebutted by reliable genetic evidence. So this is, on the one hand, ignoring the existence of intersex people, but it would also abolish the severely limited protections that exist at a federal level for trans people. In case it wasn't already clear enough, the Justice Department issued a brief to the Supreme Court telling the court that federal civil rights law banning sex discrimination in the workplace does not extend to trans people. And also, since that memo was leaked, the Department of Health and Human Services proposed getting rid of protections against discrimination on the basis of gender identity in healthcare. This is happening at the same time as abortion rights are being threatened in many states, and Roe could be challenged soon. There is an urgency to fight against these attacks because they'd have a massive impact on the lives of a lot of people, but it's not enough to only engage in defensive battles. In fighting back, we must have a positive vision for the future. We must have our eyes set on where we want to be in order to inform our strategy now. So I'd like to bring this back to the earlier part where I was talking about the theoretical connections between the struggle for trans rights and reproductive justice and against sexual assault. And in this moment, there are more people than we've seen in a long time organizing and protesting around these issues. As these struggles develop into a coherent movement, building that movement on the foundation of the politics of solidarity will be an important part of strengthening them and making sure that they're successful. In order to explain in a little bit more detail about what I mean by the politics of solidarity, I'm going to pull a bunch of quotes from Holly Lewis's book, The Politics of Everybody, because I think she puts it really well. She says, "Solidarity is not a condition that results from mature humans learning to accept diversity. It's a political recognition that our futures are tied together. Solidarity is not a matter of pluralist, multicultural unity and harmony. Solidarity implies antagonism, the taking of sides. It implies commitment to support for one's comrades. Solidarity is not the end of schism, it's the recognition of schism. Hence the old union slogan, which side are you on? Solidarity, in the political sense, is not an end in itself. It is a process that seeks to achieve the decisive resolution of a political antagonism through allied forces. So building solidarities within a politics that acknowledges everybody requires having a political goal, and it requires that partisans become solid. When the political goal is the eradication of oppression, becoming solid means that those who are not under siege have the backs of those who are. So this definition of solidarity shows that it's not enough to understand that inclusion of marginalized people and in anti-oppression movements is the right thing to do, even though it is. Arguments that are centered on ethics and morality can only go so far. We need to be putting forward a political argument for radical solidarity. It's not enough to avoid exclusion. Not being a TERF is a pretty low bar. We need active and radical inclusion of trans liberation politics into our movements. So what does that look like concretely? Imagine, if you will, a year from now, there's a National Week of Action demanding bodily autonomy for all people. That includes protests, strikes, and demonstrations, and civil disobedience. The demands of these actions include free abortion on demand, federal law guaranteeing free hormone replacement therapy and gender-affirming surgery for all trans people, and civil rights protections that explicitly protect trans people from discrimination on the basis of their trans identity. Just in case those demands seem out of reach, Ireland's recent struggle for abortion rights has led to free abortions after their ban is overturned, and Uruguay's Congress recently passed a law guaranteeing free gender-affirming surgery and hormone replacement therapy, as well as allocating 1% of all public jobs to trans people. These are the kinds of reforms are certainly possible and worth fighting for, and we need to be building the organizations that can fight for and win those reforms. To get there, we need to be participating in defensive struggles. And while we're in those struggles, we need to be building the politics of solidarity in order to point to the type of militant actions that will actually achieve reforms that can better the lives of all oppressed people. Unfortunately, I couldn't be in New York last weekend for the Queer Liberation March, but everything I've heard about it suggests that it embodied the kind of solidarity I'm talking about. A march for queer and trans liberation that was unapologetically anti-imperialist, anti-cop, anti-racist, pro-immigrant, and anti-capitalist. I'm gonna read another quote from Holly Lewis. She says, "However, no matter how much solidarity is developed in the fight against particular oppressions, oppressions will continue to be reproduced systemically until exploitation and expropriation are ended. Racism, misogyny, oppositional sexism, are all produced in from the repetition based on contingent. They're all produced from repetition based on conditions and contingencies of the organization of production and reproduction under capitalism. So these sexist ideas in our society are produced by the way we organize our society. Those ideas aren't just individual bigots thinking bigoted things. The ideas are produced by a system. We can and should fight for reforms under this current system that will improve the lives of marginalized people and enable more people to have the time and energy to become active in struggle. But in order to achieve our collective liberation, we must overturn the system that provides the material drive for oppression and exploitation. That system is, of course, capitalism, and getting rid of it means building revolutionary socialist politics and organization. We need all hands on deck to fight against these attacks now and fight for our vision of a socialist future that guarantees the right of bodily autonomy for all people.